This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. There have been a lot of fish-out-of-water buddy comedies at the movies over the years, but never quite like this. This time around, director Peter Farrelly took on a true story with his latest film, Green Book. It follows a guy known as Tony Lip, played by Viggo Mortensen, a tough-talking Italian from the Bronx. Tony gets hired as the valet to Dr. Don Shirley, played by Mahershala Ali, a virtuosic black pianist touring the Jim Crow South. They make for a very odd couple, even when they sit down for a bite to eat.
How is that?
Salty.
Have you ever considered becoming a food critic?
No. Not really. Why, is there money in it?
I'm just saying you have a marvelous way with words when describing food. Salty. So vivid one can almost taste it.
Hey, I'm just saying it's salty. And salt's cheating. Any cook can make things salty. To make it taste good without the salt, we'll just see other flavors. That's the trick.
Green Book is named for the Negro Motorist's Green Book, a travel guide for black motorists. Some call the film a feel-good movie, showing how people from different backgrounds can connect and grow. Others say a brilliant black man's story has been sacrificed to make a white man a hero. Yet again, we will discuss the film, spoilers and all, after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the YMCA, a nonprofit committed to strengthening communities. The Y believes the zip code you're born into shouldn't determine your destiny and works to create opportunity for all, no matter who you are or where you're from. Learn more about the impact of your donation at ymca.net/forabetterus. The Y, for a better us.
Why does Ecuador use the U.S. dollar? And do luxury rentals affect the housing market?
Listen to The Indicator from Planet Money to answer some of these questions and some other interesting questions from you, our listeners. Get The Indicator on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Joining us from NPR West near Los Angeles is our honorary movie club vice president, John Horn, the host of The Frame, a daily arts and entertainment program on KPCC Public Radio. Mr. Vice President, welcome back to the club.
Happy almost Thanksgiving.
Almost Thanksgiving. Joining us from NPR in New York is Alvin Hall. His BBC radio documentary, Green Book, tells the story of the real-life travel guide. Alvin, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And in Los Angeles, Brooke Obie is the managing editor of Shadow and Act, a site covering black talent and entertainment. Brooke, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's begin with your reviews. How many stars out of five and why would you give Green Book? John Horn, let's start with you.
I'm going to give it 5 out of 5. I really enjoyed this movie. It also spoke to me in a very personal way. We'll get into later my father's own experience with The Green Book. I thought it was well made. I thought it was surprising in terms of what Peter Farrelly, who is usually a kind of lowbrow comedy director, was able to do with the story. I love Don Shirley's music. I understand a lot of the complaints, but I really like this movie. So 5 out of 5, no fractions.
Well, thank you for no fractions. I appreciate that. But it sounds like you've got a very emphatic, perfect score for Green Book. And I do want to get into that personal connection a little later. But Alvin Hall, what about you? How many stars and why?
I gave it 4 stars. I thought the movie is beautifully constructed. For a movie to work well, there must be a story arc that people can relate to, that they can feel, and that they can connect with. And I thought it was beautifully constructed in that way. I thought that the Viggo Mortensen character, Tony Lip, was an extraordinary performance by Viggo, regardless of the fact that he was a racist, but he captured a particular time and place in New York City within that particular milieu in which he lived. And I thought that Mahershala's performance was good. There were some inconsistencies in the movie for me. There were some moments that bordered on cliche, but overall, it was a feel-good movie, and it worked.
Brooke Obie, what about you? How many stars out of five and why?
I would give this movie 0 stars out of 5.
Whoa.
The main issues.
You are our first 0-star review ever.
Wow. Well, I'm happy to do that for this movie. The main issues for me with Green Book are that it centers a white man's experience in what should have been, according to the title, a black story. And it misrepresents the Green Book and it misrepresents Dr. Shirley. So, you know, whether audiences would enjoy the film should be secondary to questions of whether the film harms Dr. Shirley's legacy, whether it harms his living family members, and, you know, whether it harms black people as a whole. So, I mean, I think to consistently see our stories and our black icons filtered through the lens of a racist white person like Tony Lip does nothing to advance, you know, the understanding of black history and only serves to perpetuate white supremacy.
I do want to get more into the legacy of Dr. Shirley. Just to preview what's coming later on in our conversation, we heard from some relatives of Dr. Shirley who contacted us with their thoughts on this film. We'll share some of what they said in just a moment, but let's back up a little bit. Alvin Hall, let me come back to you. We've talked about the Green Book on 1A early in our life as a program. Could you just give us the basic explanation? What was the Green Book?
The Green Book was a travel guide created by Victor Hugo Green. It came about because he would go in the summers south to Virginia to visit his wife's family. And in that drive down, they would often encounter indignations. So he started with a simple idea. What are the places where I can stop along the way so I do not have to have these frustrations and bad experiences? He was a part of a postman's union, and so at their annual meetings, he met other postmen, and gradually he asked them to start sending him information about places in their areas, in their routes, where they could stay. So starting in 1936, focusing primarily on New England, he began to publish this guide, and over the years, it expanded first along the East Coast up to the Mississippi, then across all of America. And the whole purpose of this was to help the Negro motorists find places to stay so they would not have to deal with violence, discrimination, and really demeaning behaviors.
Let me play a brief clip from your BBC radio documentary about the Green Book.
It was difficult. Most times, black families traveled, you know, safe routes. And you were very cautious.
Cautious when, where you stop, when, and how you present yourself.
You traveled during the day. You tried to get to where you were going before nightfall.
Because the least little thing could trigger violence.
Alvin, tell us a bit about some of those voices we just heard in that clip.
The second voice you heard is a very well-known civil rights leader in Tallahassee, Florida. And he tells the story in the documentary that he stopped at a gas station and the white owner made him wait and wait and wait. And then as the car hood was being lifted up, he asked if there was a restroom available. The black mechanic who was under the hood said, "Those bathrooms are fine." And he said to the guy, "Well, can I see the bathrooms?" to the white owner. The white owner then said no. A white motorist came around his car and slapped that man, saying, "We don't like your kind down here." At the same time, that man's son came out with a gun and pulled it on this person, and he slapped that man. That was a type of indignation that people encountered quite a bit in the South. Or another one was where someone was driving south and a policeman passed them on the other side, and the father had an instinct. He said, "Something is going to go wrong. This is just not right." The policeman turned around and chased them for miles just to stop them because they had a nice car.
Greta in Arlington, Virginia, right across the Potomac from here, emailed, "I was in my teens when I first read about the Green Book and the Jim Crow era that made it a necessity. I remember being astounded and horrified, reading with mouth agape and eyes tearing up. The movie doesn't fully honor that experience. How can it? Because it's played for laughs." Ugh. Tom posted on our Facebook page, "Did I watch a documentary about these two men? Nope. I watched a well-done piece of entertainment that made me want to add one man's music to my Spotify and made me want to learn more about their actual relationship. Go see the movie. Judge for yourself." Brooke Obi, could you react to that last comment from Tom? I understand what he's getting at. It may not have been a perfectly accurate film, but it sparked curiosity in him. Isn't that a good thing?
You know, it's if you're going to see it, you know, go see it. But what I would like to center is, you know, the family's response and how they felt about it and how they were treated during the process of the making of this movie. That's you know, way more important to me as a moviegoer. Those are the kinds of movies that I want to see, movies that are, you know, support if they're based on real people. They're supported by the families who are still alive. And, you know, even without talking to the family, when I wrote this review, I was very uncomfortable just sitting in the movie theater, honestly, and just seeing, you know, Dr. Shirley portrayed as this caricature of a man who was not associated in any way with the Black community, who needed Tony Lip to teach him about fried chicken and teach him, you know, how to get along with other Black people because he was supposedly estranged from his Black family and from the Black community as a whole. You can do a simple Google search and find out that that's not the case. You know, he was friends with Duke Ellington and Sarah Vaughan. He had vibrant Black musician community in New York. He performed with the Alvin Ailey Dancers. I mean, it just, you know, so things like that, when I'm watching that in the movie, that just made me uncomfortable. It didn't make me, you know, I did actually go and try and do some more research on Dr. Shirley after watching that movie, but it was mostly out of, you know, just sadness for his legacy being distorted in the way that it obviously was, even as someone who did not know very much about Dr. Shirley at all before watching the movie.
Let's get to some more of your comments and calls. Let's go to Potomac, Maryland, where Peggy is on the line. Hey, Peggy, what did you think of Green Book?
I give it a solid 4 stars. I think it's a movie that everyone should see because I think from my own experience, it portrays a very realistic it's a realistic portrayal of the way things were in many parts of the South. And I'd like to just throw in an anecdote. Mm-hmm. I was traveling during the summer of 1969 I'm a white girl. I was with a Black boy and a white boy. The three of us were traveling through East Texas. And during the morning, we stopped at a diner to get breakfast, sat at the counter. The waitress, who was white, and everybody in the diner was white, slammed down a glass of water in front of Tom, our Black friend, and said to him, "By law, I gotta serve that Black son of a beep, but I don't gotta serve you two." Needless to say, the three of us got up and walked out. We could have really used the Green Book to have avoided that kind of Southern hospitality. But I do have another vignette. Mm-hmm. The previous summer, I had stopped to see a Black friend in Cornelia, Georgia. We spent the night with her, and we were greeted so warmly and graciously by the Black community where she lived. So how you were greeted depended very much on what color your skin was back then. I thought the movie did a great job of portraying the development of their relationship and friendship.
Yeah. Well, Peggy, I really appreciate you calling in. Thanks very much for talking to us. Also glad to hear from some of you who shared your stories of how you learned about the Green Book or about the Jim Crow South. Mary writes, "I first learned of the Green Book a few years ago on NPR. I feel like its existence should have been middle school curriculum. I'm ashamed to say it was maybe only a decade ago that I really learned about the Jim Crow era. I'm 44. Irene is in Adelphi, Maryland. Irene emailed, "Having grown up in a sheltered West Coast bubble, we learned very little. Except for a few pictures in history books, we didn't learn about life in a Jim Crow South. I will be reading and learning more." John Horn, this is something that comes up a lot in dealing with these kinds of historical fictions, how much of a responsibility the studio and the filmmakers have to tell the whole story as opposed to telling a story in a historical setting, particularly because one of the writers of the film was Tony Lip's son.
Yeah, and Tony Lip's son made extensive recordings not only of Tony Lip, but also of Don Shirley. And Tony Lip says, and Peter Farrelly has told the story, that the Kentucky Fried Chicken scene actually happened, that there's a long tape of Tony Lip describing whether or not Don Shirley wanted to eat fried chicken, and they decided to put it in the movie because it was true. The bigger question is, if something isn't necessarily factual, is it truthful? And I think that's where you really get into complicated territory when you're dealing with biography. And even if this movie takes some liberties, and I'm sure it does, is it getting at an essential truth? And I think that's where the nature of our debate is. What is that truth? And I would say for me, the truth is this is how people's lives are changed. And this is the personal story I wanted to share. In 1964, my father was a sports writer at Sports Illustrated. He went down to Florida with a young boxer by the name of Cassius Clay. He was the boxing reporter for Sports Illustrated. Cassius Clay, world champion at the time, stayed in a what they called a Negro motel. My father didn't. Within a year, my father, having witnessed this and other things, quit his job at Sports Illustrated, went into the ministry as an Episcopal priest. We donated our family car to the Freedom Riders, and he changed our family's life based on what he saw in part at a Green Book Hotel. So, yes, this movie may take liberties, but what do people take away from it, and what do they learn about history, and how do they change the way they see the world going forward? And I think that's the important message of Green Book.
Let me ask you a little bit more, John. First of all, that's amazing that had such a strong experience on you, and I'm glad to hear from you and from Peggy about kind of what that era meant to white families as well as black families. William tweeted, "In the 60s, as my family traveled from Philly to South Hill, Virginia, my grandmother was our Green Book. It is a shame black stories like this are misinterpreted too many times by white directors, but better made than not." Also, some questions about the Green Book itself. Alvin, I wonder if you would respond to Dawn, who tweeted, "How many places in the Green Book are still open? Are there route maps, like for historic Route 66?
Oh, that's interesting. So when I did my documentary, we started in my area, Tallahassee, Florida, and we drove all the way to Ferguson, Missouri, following the old civil rights route. And what we discovered was that some of them still exist. The Ben Moore Hotel still exists. In Jackson, a few of the places still exist, but many of them are in disrepair. A few of the houses have been torn down as they were building the interstate highway systems. These communities were targeted often, and the houses and the businesses were destroyed. A friend of mine in California is going around now and photographing places that still exist, and some of them are even used as halfway houses. So there isn't a guide, but I think this is being put together over time. Right now, I'm working on another documentary, driving around looking for Green Book places and documenting people who remember them.
Brooke Obi, I want to come back to your concerns about the film, because there are some strong views on both sides of that. Seth wrote on our Facebook page, "Ugh, so tired of Hollywood whitewashing history. I thought this was going to teach me about something I'd never heard about. Never in a million years would I have expected the movie to try to make me warm up to a racist." However, Bob emailed, "Zero stars would indicate that this movie is worthless and without any redeeming value to viewers. As the on-air discussions prove, this movie has value on many levels, certainly worth rating more than zero." Now, members of Dr. Shirley's family contacted us before the show to say how distressed they were with the depiction in the film. We spoke this morning with Maurice Shirley, who's Don's younger brother. He's 86 now. He says he refuses to see the film because it is, in his words, full of lies. He says you only need to listen to his brother's records to appreciate his virtuosity. Recall seeing him rehearsing with the trio and chewing them out if they veered away from the notes that were on the page. He also said that unlike in the film, Dr. Shirley was not estranged from his family or the black community. Says he had definitely eaten fried chicken before. We also heard from Dr. Shirley's niece. She reached out to us and left us a voicemail. Here's what she left in our inbox.
"My name is Carol Shirley Kimball. I am the niece of Don Shirley, supposedly the subject of the movie The Green Book. There was no due diligence done to afford my family and my deceased uncle the respect of properly representing him, his legacy, his worth, and the excellence in which he operated, the excellence in which he lived. It's once again a depiction of a white man's version of a black man's life. My uncle was an incredibly proud man, and he was an incredibly accomplished man, as are the majority of people in my family. And to depict him as less than, and to depict him and to take away from him and make the story about a hero of a white man for this incredibly accomplished black man is insulting at best."
Brooke, I know we have to pause momentarily, but this seems like a tough one to try to suss out whether a movie like this is quote-unquote good or not.
I mean, it's not difficult for me at all. I mean, you know, just
well, but clearly some of our listeners are wrestling with this.
Well, you know, I think, you know, if you're wrestling it, I, what matters to me is truth. And we were talking earlier about essential truth and whether this movie gets to some essential truth. And I think you need to ask the question, truth from whose point of view? You know, we've already established that Tony Lip was a racist white man. Even director Peter Farley, in my interview with him, said, my hero is a racist white man. So, you know, we are already looking at Don Shirley through the lens of someone who is a racist white man. So there can't, I mean, what truth can you actually get from that story? I mean, where, like, you know, his niece just said, where was the due diligence? Who asked Dr. Shirley's family anything?
Let me pick this up in just a moment, but first we have to say goodbye to John Horn, host of The Frame on KPCC. John, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Thank you.
You as well.
We'll get back to our conversation in a moment. Stay close.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. Would you know if someone applied for credit using your Social Security number? If not, listen to Joe Whitchurch, head of the CreditWise app, talk about the new SSN tracker his team recently released.
While identity fraud is something everyone needs to be worried about, we want to make it easy and seamless for them to become aware of anybody attempting to use their identity without their knowledge or permission.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and this week on the TED Radio Hour, we're exploring ways to seek out joy in some places you might expect and in some places you might not. Where joy hides, check it out this week on the TED Radio Hour, wherever you get your podcasts.
Brooke, I want to play a little piece of your conversation with Mahershala Ali, who played Dr. Don Shirley in Green Book, with regards to your concern about this being a kind of a white savior film. Here's part of what he said.
When you go back in time, when you go back pre-civil rights, usually we go back and we have African Americans in a situation where they have very little power, very little say, very little voice. And I feel like there are several points throughout this story that that show you that Doc Shirley is fairly empowered throughout the journey. And if anything, is definitely empowered in that car between mm-hmm. the two of them.
And
so it doesn't. I don't think that there could be other things to complain about, like for sure, and we would have to embrace those and listen. But that element is not. I don't think you have like a white savior situation in this film.
That's Mahershala Ali, who played Dr. Don Shirley in Green Book. Now, Brooke, I understand where you're coming from. I just want to kind of close the loop on what you were saying earlier in terms of this movie being centered around this white racist who is kind of ennobled by getting over his racism. As soon as you said that, I immediately thought of the movie Schindler's List, which is about a Nazi. And it was directed, as fate would have it, by a Jewish director for a studio that was founded, Universal Pictures, by a German Jew named Carl Laemmle. I mean, and that movie won Best Picture. It was very redemptive. Like, I'm trying to put your complaint about Green Book against my love of a movie like Schindler's List.
Well, I mean, Crash also won Best Picture. I mean, there's, you know, a history in Hollywood of, like, rewarding, you know, kind of the white savior films. So, you know, the awards, I'm sure this movie will be up for plenty of awards too. I think, again, that what you really have to consider is what the impact of this movie is going to be. You know, this, you're talking about, you know, the white man, you know, ending his racism, but that's not really apparent. I mean, all that happens is he becomes friends with an individual black person and then tells his family not to call this individual black person, you know, the names that they've been calling black people throughout the whole movie. So there's not any, you know, like, because the bar for, you know, a racist growth is beneath the floor, that's supposed to be like really heartwarming and like, wow, he's made such a great evolution. I mean, but there's absolutely nothing that I've seen that he actually did after this movie or the time period depicted in this movie where, you know, he became an anti-racist or anything like that. You know, so just, you know, having a black friend does not mean that you're not racist anymore. You know, like, so, you know, I think we just really have to look at what the impact of the movie is, what it's actually saying to, you know, other people who may be dealing with, you know, some racism in, you know, in their own thought processes and are trying to filter that out. Does this movie actually help that? I mean, if you make, you know, a friend across the aisle, then, you know, is everything okay? Is the work done? You know, so, and just to have a feel-good movie, you know, about the Green Book, I mean, there's nothing feel good about Jim Crow or, you know, white supremacy. So there, that's just not enough of a reason for me to enjoy the movie.
Alvin, I also wanted to ask you about the nature of Don Shirley's character, kind of speaking, you know, from one black savant to another. I figured I'd ask you this question. Something about the Don Shirley character was very troubling. This idea, and if it's true to his life, that's one thing, but this idea of this kind of lonely black unicorn who performs for white people, something about that, though real, just got under my skin.
I agree. I think that there is the belief that in order for you to accomplish or achieve what Don did, that you have to extract yourself from your people. You have to be removed because you're so isolated that you can't relate, that people can't touch you. I found that very disturbing, and I found sometimes the way he held himself physically a little bit too regal. Granted, this was the 1960s, and there was that element within black culture where people who had achieved and were middle class held themselves a little apart, but it would not have been the way that Don Shirley did. And I'd like to make one other point, if I have the time to do so. Mm-hmm. When I came to Wall Street in 1982, I met a man who was very much like Tony Lip. This man said to me on my first day walking into this Wall Street firm, "Your mother must be so disgusted that she gave birth to somebody like you." I've never forgotten that. Never.
Well, wait, what?
He said to me as I was walking in the office of this Wall Street firm that your mother must be disgusted that she gave birth to something like you. I've never forgotten it. I've never forgotten it. This man was so racist. He was so racist. He was just racist. It was in him throughout every bone of his body. And he just didn't like black people. He didn't like me. Over the course of 10 years, and it was a decade, this man and I developed a decent friendship. I will never understand how this friendship came about. I will never understand his distinct fondness for me. But I think Brooks' line is very true. He liked me, but he didn't particularly care for black people. It was always this problem with me in me. And so when I saw the film, I thought about this man again and again and again. And sometimes I was reminded of a statement of a friend of mine, that sometimes you change a situation one life at a time. You can't change a culture all the time.
One more guest we'd like to bring in before our time is up. Of course, we mentioned that the Green Book was vital in helping black travelers navigate the country, but what about navigating the world today? Joining us from NPR in New York is Evita Robinson, the founder and creator of the Nomadness Travel Tribe. Evita, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, and we appreciate your patience as we've kind of trying to work through all the issues related to this movie.
It's been a good conversation. I've been here since the beginning listening in.
Good. There's a lot to unpack, and I'm interested in knowing more about Nomadness Travel Tribe. What is Nomadness, and why'd you create it?
Right. So we're currently an international travel group, primarily of African-American women. We are 21,000 members worldwide. We have approaching 30 regional ambassadors, and we do international and domestic trips, as well as large scale events on an annual basis, and almost 100 meetups with our group regional outspring. Annually. So we're a safe space right now, particularly for travelers of color. And it's interesting hearing all the history and obviously the research that I did on my TED Talk in talking about the Green Book as well, and seeing this bridge from Jim Crow and what we have gone through in our heritage to now us creating and needing digital safe spaces, right? So it shows, you know, the technology, the social media generation that we're in right now, but also understanding that we still very much are in a place where we need, you know, our community, and we need a place to be able to vent and to be honest and to, you know, feel safe. And, you know, we've created a space that is definitely online, but it's also led to offline domestic and international safe spaces for our community as well. And I created it because I needed it.
What are some of the big concerns that your members describe in terms of traveling nationally and internationally?
I mean, it's really about safety, right? It's the same thing as everybody else. We want to make sure that we're going to a place and we're traveling with a community of people that aren't just tolerating us, you know? Like, if we wanted to deal with all the ails of racism and, you know, post Jim Crow and all of these other things, you know, the new Jim Crow, we could stay at home for that right now. And so, right. You know, there's a sense of escapism, but also a sense of acceptance and safety that we want to have. And I think that's why we really gravitate towards our own internally created communities and kind of branch off from there.
Give me a sense of when, in terms of one of the trips that your members want to take, like what it would mean to take a trip that just works, where none of these issues come up, where everything is just cool. Like, what would that mean to the members of your group to be able to take a trip that is that good?
I mean, we've done over 30 trips with them over the last 6 years, right? So, for instance, next, within 3 weeks, we're actually doing Zanzibar and Johannesburg, South Africa for New Year's.
Oh, nice.
And so the first time that we went to South Africa was very interesting. And every time we go back, because I'm going to tell you something, our members are looking for places where being Black is revered. You know, it's not something that's held against us. It's not something that we have to overcome or feel like we're fighting. Again, we could stay home for that. And so we had a theme for this trip in South Africa, which is freedom, freedom in Joburg. And everything that we're doing on our itinerary is wrapped around that, from the Apartheid Museum, the Nelson Mandela, Soweto tours, all the way to even celebrating, you know, New Year's, going to the Afropunk Festival for a creative and musical type of freedom. You know, us creating things around their interests. And I think what's interesting about Nomadness and our group trips is that we can funnel the information and create itineraries that are actually derived from our members who live there.
Right.
So this could be some place that is, you know, extremely white, but we may have, you know, a cluster of Nomadness members that live there and they are our guides. We will pick from them and be like, what does your experience look like here? And
right,
we
right.
start there.
And Davida, you're exploring the idea. I understand you're exploring the idea of what a new age of what a 2018, 2019 green book might look like.
Yes, absolutely. So I signed with a major nonfiction literary agency earlier this year, and I wanted to do an extension of my TED Talk and also explore what that looks like. And I think a big component of that is our stories, right? So digitally now, it's not necessarily addresses and, you know, phone numbers of different places, but it's more so how have we been received in different places around the world? What does this country look like? How are you received in this city? And so we are actually compiling 100 interviews right now from different Black and brown travelers from around the world and getting their experiences. And, you know, it's an offshoot. We just did Audacity Fest, which is the first festival in the country, on September 8th in Oakland. That is for Black and brown travelers. And some of our panels included, you know, traveling under Trump 2.0. And we had a Syrian American, Muslim American, African American, mm-hmm. everybody on there, because we need to have these conversations. This is very real for us in our generation. LGBTQ travel panels, we're really talking to the intersectionality within the whole, you know, buzzword of diversity and travel and making sure that we're representing that.
Let me get to one or two real quick comments before we have to wrap. Kathleen tweeted, "I also hate when Mr. White Savior appears in movies. And I'm white. Hated the added scene in Hidden Figures where Kevin Costner attacks the colored restroom sign with a crowbar in the secure government facility. That never happened in the book. She had to save herself." Jose emails, "I've not seen this movie, but I will. Some of your guests are under the impression that a movie has to be historically accurate. For better or worse, that's not so. In this case, the movie's a rendition from a person's point of view of events that took place in the past." Before we go, Alvin Hall, very briefly, what do you think in terms of the Green Book today? Do we still need a Green Book, or have we come a little farther than that before we got to go?
No, I think Evita's point is very true, that we do need some reference points so we know where to avoid certain problems when we travel around America as well as the rest of the world. Something like the Green Book is needed.
And Brooke, what about you? Do we still need a Green Book today?
Absolutely agree with both. You know, I was just traveling just last year. I went on an impromptu trip to Montgomery, Alabama from Macon, Georgia. And I actually just miscalculated how long it was going to take me to get back. And it was very dark. And I was terrified. I was terrified the entire trip. And I thought about Sandra Bland. And I thought about Renisha McBride. And I thought about all of these Black women who were on road trips. And, you know, they're no longer with us because of their encounters with police, because of their encounters with, you know, a white neighbor who did not recognize Renisha McBride as a human being who needed help. So I would like to have known, you know, where the safe places between Montgomery, Alabama and Macon, Georgia that I could have gone to kind of get my bearings. That would have been great.
Brooke Obi, the managing editor of Shadow and Act. Brooke, thanks very much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alvin Hall, the creator of the BBC Radio documentary Green Book. Alvin, thanks again.
You're always welcome.
And Evita Robinson, founder and creator of Nomadness Travel Tribe. Thanks, Evita.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This month's Movie Club was produced by Stephanie Collette. To learn more about her and the rest of our staff, visit the1a.org/staff. As we go out to Don Shirley's rendition of Makin' Whoopi, I should tell you this program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Safe travels this Thanksgiving weekend. This is 1A.